All right, so, Joshua, and unfortunately the way I'm doing this, I don't have screen mirroring because I tried to be fancy. So, all right, so the title of the class is going to be, not going to be, it is Stories You've Heard Before, because who knows something about the book of Joshua? Raise your hand. Who knows something about Joshua? Does anyone not know anything about Joshua? Really? Nothing. It's about a guy named Joshua. So there you go. You've officially learned something in class already, and we're just getting started. Anyway, most of us have studied Joshua, but one of the interesting things that I found is, when's the last time you studied Joshua? When's the last time you studied Joshua as an adult? I don't know until this class that I had ever studied Joshua as an adult. We had studied little lessons from Joshua and tidbits from Joshua. We had done things like that, but we hadn't really ever dug into Joshua as a book on its own. So that's what I wanted to do, and we're going to go through some highlights of that. So, all right. There are lots of themes about that you can think of and ways you can attack the book of Joshua. One of them is it's just an account of the leadership of Joshua. Very simply, it is what Joshua did when he took over and led the children. Most of that is a military campaign. It is the campaign of the conquest of Canaan, turning it into Israel. And so, yeah, sometimes that people talk about God and his promises, and they'll liken it to the Old Testament version of the book of Acts. A whole lot of promises in the Gospels, and then it transitions into execution, into action in the book of Acts. And that's why it's called the book of Acts. And so some people liken Joshua to that. God made whole lots of promises, and this is now the actual fulfillment of those promises, the start of the fulfillment of those promises. But I want to talk about beginnings and endings. This came, let's see if it works better that way. All right, this came up to me just as a thought. So, beginning and endings, it begins and ends with death. Whose death does it begin with? Moses. Whose death does it end with? Joshua. Okay. See, the questions are going to start easy. It's not a problem. It begins and ends with oral histories. So the oral history, technically Moses leaves the oral history at the end of Deuteronomy. So I'm cheating just a little bit, but bear with me. There's an oral history where Moses tells them all about their past. And then he sings a song for them. And then he dies and Joshua takes over. Joshua, when Joshua ends, he's going to do the exact same thing. It begins with Joshua issuing commands. But the question is, how does it end? And I gave you a very big hint. It's the famous verse. How does it end?
Choose your choice.
That's right. He gives you a choice. Choose you this day whom you will serve. You get to choose. So he starts by barking orders and commands, and he ends with a choice. Interestingly enough, Moses actually did the same thing, but that's neither here nor there for this point. It's a very different leadership style than the start, and so that is kind of the way I want to play through the book real quick, yeah. And then the other question, it begins with Joshua assuming leadership. Who takes over when he dies? The judges? Kind of. Right? We got the transition from Moses to Joshua. Let's take a look at that for a few minutes. Go ahead and get into Joshua chapter 1. Actually, maybe a little bit in Deuteronomy as well. So if you're not in Joshua 1 yet, go ahead and turn there. The transition from Moses to Joshua, it was methodically executed. If you go look at Deuteronomy chapter 31, Moses spends the first 8 verses explaining the takeover to everybody. The transition is explained to everybody. Then, in verses 14 and 15, God summons Joshua personally to commission him in front of everybody. The pillar of cloud that's been following him around this whole time descends on Joshua to say, in as many different ways as they can, hey, Joshua's the guy. It was Moses. Now it's going to be Joshua. And so, let's see. I'm losing track of which questions I had. Yeah, okay. He just saw it. All right, we cheated. Okay. Well, we'll just leave it up there. So the question is, why was this methodology important to Moses and to God? Think back to when Moses assumed command. What happened to Moses? How was he given authority? At the burning bush, God said, "You're doing it." And Noah's like, "No, no, 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 no." And God said, "No, trust me." And what did he give him?
Signs,
he gave him miracles. He could, you know, put his hand in his coat and it'd be leprous. He could do wonders, signs, miracles. The people immediately started blaming Moses when things went sour. After, you know, they accepted his signs and wonders for a little bit, and then they started grumbling. Once they got out, what happened once they got out and they were finally free? What happened to his leadership then? I'm asking for a lot of Bible history to come out of your brains. Sorry. Korah? Yes. Well, there's lots of them. That's kind of the point, right? Korah's rebellion. That's the first one.
Yeah, you could say it was
spotty. It was spotty at best. His leadership.
Disobeying with the water and the rock. And then,
yep.
Of course, Israel, the golden
calf. I don't know if you're talking about past that. Yeah. Yeah. You've got those. You've got Korah's rebellion, where they literally tried to usurp Moses' authority. You've got Miriam and Aaron. They said, "Hey, we're just as cool as he is. We're going to take over too." And Miriam got leprosy and a whole bunch of bad things. Korah's rebellion, it took multiple days. One day of death from the rebellion wasn't enough. They still rose up the second day and did it again. And he had to put that rebellion down too. So you can see time and time again through Moses and also through other people in the Old Testament. When Saul dies, a bunch of people try and put his remaining son Ishbosheth on the throne instead of David. And so you've got a divided kingdom. You've got Ishbosheth and you've got David. You've got David's son Absalom. And so you have all of these power dynamics, these power struggles. So this is an extraordinarily important thing to get right. So all that to say, I think it is extraordinarily purposeful that nobody is listed as taking over. Because the whole point was for nobody to take over. They're supposed to grow. Almost every other time that we've mentioned, and almost every time I can think of, but I'm not going to be categorical about it, every time it's been important who takes over, and the Bible mentions it. All the kings, it always mentions which king took over afterwards, all the judges. In fact, the point of the judges is that nobody took over. After one judge died, nobody took over. The children went away back into sin, and then another judge had to be brought up. Right, that's the whole lesson. Okay, so this book isn't just about conquest. This book is about the maturing of the people, right? Because if no one takes over, they have to be able to self-govern. And so I want to look at this book through the lens of that kind of growth. So we're going to look at a couple different things. There we go. All right, we're going to look at the baseline, where we start from. We're going to look at Jericho, specifically Rahab and Achan and Ai. We're going to look at the Gibeonites, and we're going to look finally at the eastern tribes at the end of the book. So those are our four things, and hopefully we get through all four of them. All right, I'm still fiddling with all the things on the desk. Sorry. All right, we need infinite desk space. That's what we need. All right, so baseline. What do we have? Can someone read for me, if you don't mind? Can someone read chapter 1, verses 16 through 18? I'm trying to keep the reading short. I'm trying to keep them devoid of confusing names so that they are easy to read. Go ahead, Dennis.
And they answered Joshua, saying, "All that you command us, we will do. And wherever you send us, we will go. Just as we heeded Moses in all things, so we will heed you. Only the Lord your God be with you as he was with Moses. Whoever rebels against your command and does not heed your words and all that you command him shall be put to death. Only be strong and of good courage."
Okay, so what kind of people are we starting with?
Righteous people.
Righteous and obedient, okay. What about these words would not necessarily... What about the situation would not necessarily make you confident in these words that they're saying?
Your God.
I'm sorry?
They said it was his God.
That is one good point. Yes, they said your God. We'll obey your God. That is actually a very good That's a tell in the Old Testament. You can see it throughout the prophets, and you can see it here in Joshua, that whoever they ascribe ownership of that God to, it tends to matter. Dennis?
Well, they said, just as we heeded Moses in all things, which they did not do.
Yeah. No wonder God had to tell Joshua to be strong and courageous a bunch of times, right?
It seems like in verse 18 they already accept them that there's going to be some rebellion. Whoever rebels against you, so it's not necessarily the most confidence.
That's right. Yeah, we know it's going to happen. We'll take care of it. Right. Yeah. So, there's some... We're on shaky ground here. We're not on the firmest of ground. We've just entered the land. We haven't done anything yet. Actually, they haven't even crossed over yet. So they're still on the eastern side at this point. They got to spend the first couple chapters crossing over. So they're still on the eastern side. Their parents' generation were not the best examples. They were not the best at obedience. They were pretty rotten. And so, yeah, we're starting out on shaky ground here. Okay. So they talk a good game. All right. Now we'll probably spend a bunch of time here. Let's spend some time with Rahab. Can someone read chapter 2, verses 8 through 13 for us?
Now before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, I know that the Lord has given you the land, that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you. We have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted, neither did there remain any more courage in anyone because of you, for the Lord your God. He is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. Now therefore I beg you, swear to me by the Lord, since I have shown you your kindness, that you also will show kindness to my father's house and give me a true token. And spare my father, my mother, my brothers, my sisters, and all that they have, and deliver our lives.
All right, thank you. Okay, so we have Rahab's speech, right? The spies have just entered Jericho. They made the way to Rahab's house, and let's not talk about all the reasons why, because that's pretty strange. You've got a whole bunch of Israelites that wind up at a prostitute's house. But they do, and she gives them this speech. What does she know from this passage?
Exodus.
I'm sorry?
Okay,
she knows about them leaving, right? This is some of that evidence. What she knows those facts, and what has that led her to conclude?
Nobody is going to withstand you.
Nobody's going to withstand you. That's right. The Lord God has given Israel this land. This land is your land. This land is your land. Right? It's all their land. We know. We absolutely know. We're all afraid, right? Verse 9. We are all afraid and we are melting away before you. We cannot stand. Other Josh.
This brings to mind. It's you just asked, what kind of people is Joshua leading? And that passage did not instill very good confidence. And this is the that was led out of Egypt, led through all of the wilderness, and all of that has thus conquered all of the nations to the east, just so they can get to what's on the west. And we know where they are mentally, because we have the wonderful Monday morning quarterback position. Where
yes, the hindsight.
The game plays out. We know where their mind is. What Albert said, your God, your God will obey you as your God commands you to do X, Y, Z. Here's Rahab. Dude, everybody in the land totally gets it. We're done for.
Yep. Yeah, and it's not just Rahab, it's the whole town. And she lists off the history of the recent history of Israel, right? She lists off, yeah, we know what you did to Egypt in the Exodus. We know how authoritatively you exited that land. We know what you did along the way, and we know what you did just across the river, because we don't have neighbors anymore. we know. They're gone. We get it. We've just been waiting for you to cross the river, and here you are, so we know it's time. And we're done. Like, I don't know what to do short of beg you guys. And so that's her admission, and she's admitting that the entire town feels that way. Okay. Yeah. So there's a whole bunch of stuff about the destruction of the Amorites. It's intense. You should go back into Deuteronomy and read the destruction of the Amorites. It's amazing. Numbers, sorry, not Deuteronomy. Numbers 21 is where it is. One verse that I liked that stands out. So they defeated him and his sons and all his people until he had no survivor left. And when you recount the number of cities they took over between Sihon and Og on the eastern side, it was 60. 60 towns they obliterated and just took over. So they've been living in 60 towns they didn't have to build, with 60 towns worth of farms they didn't have to plant. I mean, they're actually sitting pretty right now. That's where the 2.5 eastern tribes come from. They're like, hey, why don't we just stay here? Anyway, sorry, we're digressing. All right, what else? Okay, can someone read the end of the chapter for us, verses 23 and 24? All right, so what's the report? What do they say?
Easier than a slam dunk. God's Lord controlled the host. He's
yep.
Just right there.
Yep. Front, Josh? Were you saying something too?
It's ours.
It's ours. Truly God has given us this land. The people melt away before us. Whose line was that? Who just said it?
Rahab.
They stole her line. I think it's a good line. But they stole her line. So the question then is, how does their faith compare to Rahab's? I mean, Josh too was already talking about it. Sorry, Josh Jackson. I'll get all the names eventually.
Technically,
you're Josh 3. Sorry. Well, he's not here today. Or he's back somewhere. Anyway. okay, so how does her faith compare? Look at the evidence you've got. What's Rahab's faith like versus the faith of the spies? Who encouraged who? Who built the other person's faith in God up? Rahab built their faith up. They needed validation. They needed to go spy things out. Rahab didn't need that. Rahab already knew. She was already believing. She already knew it. Didn't believe it. She knew it was a fact. And you focus on verse 11, where she says, there is no spirit left in any man in Jericho. It wasn't just Rahab that felt this way. They all knew what was coming. Had this changed much in Jesus' day? Does anyone remember the Jesus and the centurion? Truly I say to you, not even in Israel have I found such faith. That's Luke 7, maybe other places, but Luke 7 is the one I wrote down. It's amazing that sometimes the best faith, the greatest faith, doesn't come from God's people. That's one minor lesson we could take from this. All right, so not a great start. Not a great start when a pagan prostitute's faith is as good as yours is. But they come around, and eventually they get there, right? And we know that they then go on and they conquer Jericho and they follow God's rules to a T. Except for one problem. And that's the next problem we're going to talk about. And at this point, we have to fast forward because we have the whole destruction of Jericho in the next couple chapters. So the next chapter we're going to read is chapter 7. Can someone read verses 1 through 9 for us?
But the people of Israel profaned the regard to the devoted to them. For Achan, the son of Carmi, son of Zabdi, son of Zerah, the tribe of Judah, took some of the devoted things, and the anger of the Lord burned against the people of Israel. Joshua sent men from Jericho to Ai, which is near Beth-Aven, east of Bethel, and said to them, "Go up and spy out the land." And the men went up and spied out Ai. And they returned to Joshua and said to him, "Do not have all the people go up, but let about 2,000 or 3,000 men go up and attack Ai. Do not make the whole people toil up there, for they are few." So about 3,000 men went up there from the people, and they fled before the men of Ai. And the men of Ai killed about 36 of their men and chased them before the gate as far as Shebarim, and struck them at the descent. And the hearts of the people melted and became as water. Then Joshua tore his clothes and fell to the earth on his face before the ark of the Lord until the evening, he and the elders of Israel. And they put dust on their heads, and Joshua said, "Alas, O Lord God, why have you brought this people over the Jordan at all, to give us into the hands of the Amorites to destroy us? Would that we have been content to dwell beyond the Jordan. O Lord, what can I say when Israel has turned their backs before their enemies? For the Canaanites and all the inhabitants of the land will hear of it and will surround us and cut off our name from the earth. And what will you do for your great name?"
All right, thank you very much. Sorry, you drew the short straw with all the names, but thank you. That one was unavoidable. We had to do the name somewhere. Okay, so what did Achan do? He stole from God. He took the devoted things. And what is God's reaction? Punishment to who? Israel. So he's angry at the whole assembly because one dude did a thing. How do the people deal with Ai? Like the first Ai, not the repeat, not the mulligan. How do they deal with Ai? It was utter despair. What did they try and do? They sent spies. What did the spies say? Yeah, just send a couple people. There's not many people. Just send 2,000 or 3,000 men. It'll get taken care of. Don't bother everybody. Dennis.
The first mistake, they should have inquired of the Lord. If they had done that, then they would have been rebuked at that time.
Right. They do not appear to know that God is upset with them. They don't know what's about to happen. So there's problem number one. Problem number two, they sent out spies, and you know they're obviously not doing it God's way because they didn't even ask. So they're overconfident, and they suffer a pretty abysmal defeat. I don't remember what Josh Jackson's exact phrase was. I think I'm pretty far ahead of my questions. There we go. No, I wasn't. Just one question. How do they react to defeat?
Wrongly. Yeah. He questions God instead of saying, you know, instead of recognizing what did we do wrong, he turns the blame to God. Why have we allowed this? It's an interesting situation because you wonder how many knew of the sin. Obviously, Joshua didn't here. I mean, once they were defeated, he should have connected the dots and said, we did something wrong, even if he didn't know the exact thing that was amiss in Israel. But
yep.
Even though not everyone knew, like you mentioned, everybody was punished in a sense because of the loss of life there. That impacted many in Israel, not just the ones that lost it. And
right.
It
Yep. So they kind of lose it. They fall apart. They are being dramatic, and they're throwing ashes all over the place, and they're starting to question God. There's a refrain of "let's just turn back"-ism going on, right? So you can see it. Maybe we should have just stayed on the other side of the river. It was pretty nice over there. I mean, they didn't say let's go back to Egypt like their parents did, but they're pretty close. They're pretty close to that same idea. In fact, it is the same idea. They just want to go back to a different place. A place that God said was okay, not Egypt, which God said never go back there ever again. Ever, 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 ever. Never trust the Egyptians for as long as you live. And he meant it. Let's just turn back. So, you know, to the good times. Was across the river good times? No, not really. They had 60 cities. That was awesome. But if you look at the eastern side of the river and what that looks like versus the western side of the river and what that looks like, it's a night and day difference. There's a reason it was called the land flowing with milk and honey. It was a lot better. Eastern side, you immediately get into the deserts of the Middle East, and it's pretty rotten out there. So, it wasn't really good times. They're overdramatic. And God's response, I love God's response. God's response, we didn't read it. It's in verse 10 and verse 13. He says, get up. Get up. You can just see. I'm sure all us parents have been there. Get up. You're being dramatic. Get up. It's not that bad. I mean, it is that bad. People died. But get up. Yeah, maybe some of us had to say that this morning. I understand. Anyway, one little bonus. Does anyone happen to remember how detailed the conquest of Ai eventually winds up being? Does anyone have that tucked away in their brain other than me who prepared for this like last night? No. Okay, that's fine. Eventually, they have to cleanse the camp, right? So they have to deal with Achan. And they kill him and his family and his livestock and his tent, and everything's gone. Completely wipe Achan from the history of the nation, basically. Then they consecrate and devote themselves. Then they go say, all right, God, what do you want us to do? And it's this huge thing. There's like 5,000 people that are going to be bait. They're going to be the main attack force. And then there's going to be 30,000 people waiting in the wing in ambush to come get them as soon as they draw the people out of the city. But then you got a problem because the people of Bethel come in, and so you have this huge fight, and it takes forever. And eventually they win. It's a far cry from the, send 2,000 or 3,000 people. It'll be fine. That the spies thought was okay. God's plan turned out to be a lot more involved. God knew a thing or two, evidently. Okay, so this time it took 2 tries. But they got there. They did it. Eventually. They hopefully have learned from their mistake. That's kind of the path of growth, is learning from our mistakes. This was a pretty painful mistake. Several dozen men died. And they were demoralized, and they were right in thinking that their name was going to be a laughingstock through the nations. But that doesn't last long, does it? Okay. And after this, right after this is when they do the Mount Ebal, Mount Gerizim thing. If you were paying attention to this slide at the start of the show, that was those mountains. And there's a city in between them. And does anyone remember that city's name that's in between the two mountains? This is trivia. I don't know why I'm doing this. Okay, never mind, because I also forgot. I meant to write it down. I forgot. It's either Shechem or Shiloh, and I can't remember which one. So anyway, all right. Shame on me. Okie doke. So, let's go on and move to the third thing. The Gibeonites. The Gibeonites, this is a fun one. Can someone read chapter 9, verses 3 through 8, and then verse 18? Oh, come on. Verse 18, please. All right, thank you very much. Okay, so what do the men of Gibeon do? Basic facts.
Why?
They lie? Okay. How do they lie? What's the ruse?
We came from a far country. We live right next door.
All right. We came from a far country. So they're trying to trick Israel into making a pact, a peace alliance with them. They know full well, if you read the whole context, they know full well what their instructions from God were for the children of Israel, not to do such a thing. And so they have to do it by subterfuge. Okay. They pretend to be wanderers. They put on, you know, rotten clothes and old bags, and they come up looking like beggars. What do the Israelites say in verse 7? What do the people say? Okay, why? Should we make a covenant with these people?
You might dwell amongst us.
You might be locals. Right? They're not stupid. They know. They absolutely know. But who doesn't listen? Verse 15, we didn't actually read this, but one man makes the decision. You can guess whose name, what his name is. In fact, it might be your name. Not Hillary. Right. Verse 15, Joshua makes the decision. The leaders make the decision. He overrules the shrewdness of the people. And he makes the alliance anyway. Another verse we didn't really read. I skipped that. Okay. So what is the reaction when they eventually do find out? When they reach Gibeon, it only takes 3 days, by the way, to get there. 3 days and they see those dudes. That's pretty rotten. What happens when they get there? Verse 18, they didn't attack them because they're not allowed to, because they made a promise, they made an oath before God, and they're not going to do that. They're not going to go back on that. And what else do they do? They make them slaves. What do they do before they make them slaves? There's one little thing in between.
Complain against the rulers.
They complain. They grumble against the rulers. Now, this is people with a long history of grumbling. But in this instance, I see this as the turning point. This is the point at which the people have grabbed hold of that faith and they've made it their own. They were right. Why were they grumbling? Right? Normally they grumble because they were unhappy with their physical plight. Right? That's what their parents did. These people grumbled for a different reason. Why did they grumble? Yeah, we're not supposed to do this, Joshua, you dolt. We're not supposed to do this. Not you specifically. I will never not be able to make these jokes during a Joshua class. It's going to be great. One of them is always going to be in here. I made a joke and I got myself distracted. All right. So, right, they're ready. They're ready to follow God. They wanted to be cautious. And Joshua's like, nah, let's make the alliance. Look at them. Look at them. They obviously came a long way. No one would ever trick us like that. And so they're angry for the right reasons, and they're grumbling at their leadership for the exact right reason, because their leadership isn't cutting it. They made a mistake. These people have their faith now. And I think this instance is when you see the tide turn for the people of Israel, and you see them really start to gain momentum and accelerate. Then there's a whole lot more going on that we just don't have time to get into about what happens after the Gibeonite thing. They get drawn into a big war with a whole bunch of northern nations with this Gibeonite thing because the Gibeonites can't fight for themselves because they made them their slaves, which means they took away all their weaponry, right? They cannot defend themselves, so they like, hey, Israel, you got to come help us. You said you'd take care of us, and we would be your servants, so let's do it. So they get dragged into this huge war in the north. Anyway. But I really like this. This reminds me of watching my kids do the right thing for the right reason without my intervention. And seeing that is the feeling I get when I read this passage. That yeah, it was a mess up, but it was the leader's mess up and not the children's mess up. Okay. And then we've got 10 minutes to do the last one. The Eastern tribes. Sir.
Good example of the
Yeah. Right. This one little sin, this one little mistake on Joshua's part, it explodes into a lot of different things. Like what you were talking about with the ultimate resolution during King David's time, there's also the influence of the Gibeonites, the continued influence, evil influence of the Gibeonites throughout their history. The people like that become a plague upon the people of Israel because they continually reinfest the Israelites with foreign gods and bad influence. And so there's a whole lot of ways in which that gets really really exacerbates the problems of Israel. So good point. Okay, so the final one here, the Eastern tribes, item number 4. We got just enough time probably to make this happen. Is it quarter till or 10 till that we stop? I don't even know. Okay, so the first bell is going to ring in just a minute. Got it. All righty, can someone read, now we fast forward quite a bit, the majority of Joshua ends at chapter 11. Chapter 11 is the end of the conquest era. And then all the rest of these chapters are the dividing up of the land. There's a couple of really cool little vignettes of stories sprinkled into that. And then we get to Joshua's final days in the last couple of chapters. And so we're fast-forwarding to that. Can someone read 22, 9 through 12, and then 28 and 29?
So the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and half tribes of Manasseh returned and departed from the children of Israel to Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan, to go to the country of Gilead, to the land of their possession, which they obtained according to the word of the Lord by the hand of Moses. And when they came to the region of the Jordan, which is in the land of Canaan, the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and the half tribe of Manasseh built an altar there by the Jordan, a great impressive altar. Now the children of Israel heard someone say, "Behold, the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and the half tribe of Manasseh have built an altar on the frontier of the land of Canaan, in the region of the Jordan, on the children of Israel's side." And when the children of Israel heard it, the whole congregation of the children of Israel gathered together at Shiloh to go to war against them. And then dropping down verse 28.
Yep.
Therefore we said that it will be, when they say this, to us or to our generations in time to come, that we may say, "Here is the replica of the altar of the Lord, which our fathers made, though not for burnt offerings nor for sacrifices, but it is a witness between you and us. Far be it from us that we should rebel against the Lord and turn from the following Lord this day and build an altar for burnt offerings, for grain offerings, or for sacrifices, besides the altar of the Lord, which is before his tabernacle."
All right, thank you very much. Okay, so the 2.5 tribes that have been helping with the conquest, they traversed the Jordan, helped with the conquest for years, and now it's time for them to go home. They're ready to cross back over. Joshua sends them back home in peace, and what do? When they reach the Jordan River, they're not even across it yet. What do? They build an altar. An imposing altar on the western side. So it's not on their side, it's on the other guy's side. They're already splitting up. Yeah, so it's already happening. And how do the people react? That's right, they pick up their swords. They muster the army back at Shiloh, which have been kind of their meeting spot for this whole conquest time. They continually return to Shiloh. They hear that there's an altar and that the children have gone into apostasy because they've already built another altar. We're only supposed to have one altar. They've learned the lesson of Achan, haven't they? As soon as they learn their sin in the camp, they go to take care of it. But here's an interesting question. We didn't get to read it because we don't have time to read the whole book of Joshua, but who is leading the charge here? Who is leading the effort? I mean, you can say, is it Joshua or not Joshua? It's not Joshua. It's the people. It is actually Eleazar the priest. Eleazar? Phinehas. Sorry, Phinehas, son of Eleazar. It's the priest. The people are doing this without Joshua. I mean, he might be there, but he's not mentioned. He's not forcing the issue. We finally have these people again, taking their faith into their own hands and taking their relationship with God into their own hands. This is exactly what God has been aiming for this whole time, and it's happened. It had to take, you know, a seemingly horrible event like this. But it turns out that it's not so bad, right? How is it resolved? Was this altar a bad altar? I got one no. No, it's not a bad altar, right? It was not an altar for, you know, worshiping pagan gods. It was not an altar for offering any sacrifices of any sort. It was a memorial. What was it a memorial for? We did read that, right? Yeah. To remind them, it's a witness between you and us, verse 29. Into verse 28. It is a witness between us and you. It's not for sacrifice. It's a reminder so that when either of us look at the river and look across the river, we can remember, oh yeah, God's the one that joins us together. Because they knew a river is going to be a big boundary. It's going to be hard. It's going to be hard to be a united nation when you're separated by such a gigantic boundary. When the Jordan River floods, by the way, during the flood season, it is a mile wide. It's enormous. And it is impassable during flood season. It just can't be done. So, you know, it may not be deep, but it's going to be a real problem for people to get back and forth. It's a huge natural barrier. They don't have bridges like we do. Okay. Sir? Yep. That's right. We have our own memorials. We have our own witnesses that are going to be similar to that. So I hope the lesson has been good. We're done, obviously, because the bell just rang. But I hope that you see that that this is kind of a golden age for Israel. I would say that it rivals or exceeds even the time of David. These people eventually were spiritually amazing. It took a while, and you can see their growth, you can see their struggles. But I hope you found that encouraging. I hope that was good. I tried to make it as interactive as possible. That's hard to do on a one-day class. But thank you guys for everything.